Hello and welcome to the May podcast for the IASB and FESB joint insurance contracts meeting. My name is Andrea Pride, I'm a technical principal at the IASB and I'm joined today by Daryl Scott, one of our board members. Daryl, we all had a lovely time in Norwalk last week and we made some very important decisions for insurance, I think. We covered four topics, the risk adjustment and residual margin unlocking, the use of other comprehensive income, unbundling, and acquisition costs. So I think, you know, these are four topics which we've discussed many times over the course of the project, and I think it's nice that we're beginning to come round into conclusions on some of them. So let's start with the first one, the risk adjustment and the residual margin. Now this was an ISB-only meeting, of course, and the question on the table really was, did the ISB want to confirm its previous decisions?
Thanks, Andrea. Risk and residual margin is one of the key differences that we have between the FASB and the ISB approach to insurance accounting. In April, we had an education session from the FASB, which gave us a view on how they would account for their single composite margin. This was the opportunity for us as a board to talk about whether or not we had heard enough in that session to make us believe that our decision needed to be changed or needed to be re-looked at. I think it was important that the board discussed it and that the board clearly understood the difference between the two models. And based on the discussion we had, the ISB board has agreed to retain its original decisions. That's to say, to retain a residual and risk margin, because we believe that gives a better representation of the underlying dynamics of an insurance contract, and it utilizes information that insurance companies have and which users of the financial statements will find useful.
And it was a fairly unequivocal vote on the ISB's part. I think it was 11-3 with the same three who've been against the idea of a risk adjustment from the start.
Correct.
The other thing we discussed at that meeting was about unlocking the residual margin. And I think that was a little bit closer in terms of the vote, but still a clear indication that the board wanted to confirm unlocking for changes in estimates of future cash flows.
The unlocking discussion is a fairly complicated one, because not only was it necessary for us to decide whether or not we believed unlocking is the appropriate representation of the components of a profit of an insurance contract, but we also needed to decide what to unlock. And I think, again, it was useful for the board to air its thoughts on the process. We've had a lot of information that's come to us since we originally took the decision. The boards did confirm the decision. We had a little bit of further discussion about how you would treat risk and whether risk should actually be taken through the unlock margin, but in the end agreed to stick with where we are at the moment, which is to say that we would only unlock the residual margin for changes in the cash flow estimates.
Okay, and that decision was taken in the light of the fact that we would still have some further details that we wanted to resolve in the residual margin and how we unlock it, how it works operationally, and some of the details. So although the board gave a very clear indication of the direction it wanted to go into, I guess it is still a little bit premature to say it's done, dusted for good.
Absolutely.
Now, the residual margin unlocking leads nicely into OCI, because of course one of the things you could unlock a residual margin for would be changes in discount rate, and the changes in discount rate were the centre of the discussion about the use of other comprehensive income. Some very strongly held and clearly expressed views at the board table then last week, and we had both an education session for the ISB only and then a decision making session for the joint boards.
Yeah, Andrea, I think this was a particularly difficult decision for the board to make. In essence, what we were trying to do was weigh up the advantages on the one side of increased transparency and a consistent treatment through profit and loss, against, on the other side, industry concerns around volatility of the income statement, volatility in the profit and loss of the results. And in particular, I think an industry concern that short-term volatility arising from changes in interest rates set them at an industry disadvantage to other industries, for example banking, which have the opportunity to use amortized cost. In the end, the boards believed that the concerns of industry outweighed the need for very specific profit and loss reporting. We were comfortable, given the fact that we had now improved the balance sheet to reflect a current value, that current value was sufficient information for users of the financial statements, and that the OCI statement in this circumstance would present very clear and specific information about moves in discount rates. And that taken together, those two sets of information would be useful to users of the financial statements. I think it's quite important in emphasizing this that the boards discussed at length what would be shown in profit and loss and what would be shown in OCI. And we believe from the perspective of looking particularly at times when interest rates have moved a lot, that it's necessary for users to use both profit and loss and OCI in order to get a clear understanding of what's happening in the company.
One of the themes I detected as we went through the discussions was this concern about the complexity, both of the operationality of implementing an OCI approach, and also for understanding what it meant, needed to be balanced against, you know, the need to keep it simple, not to impose too many requirements. So you saw that a little bit in the discussion about interest sensitive features, about whether you apply a current discount rate locked in at the start, or whether you use the locked in at inception rate, and all the rest of it. There was also concern around the loss recognition test, that might have been a new step, really, something that's beyond something that's in the existing IFRSs, and the boards in the end decided not to have a loss recognition test for pretty much that reason.
And I think that's correct. I think having taken the OCI decision and having accepted that we were going to have OCI as an additional complexity in insurance reporting, we then went out of our way to make sure that the rest of the decisions that we took supported keeping the OCI concept as simple as possible. So, for example, we will require the use of OCI for insurers going forward. As you mentioned, we won't have a loss recognition test, and that the discount rate that will be used for or recorded in profit and loss will always be the discount rate that was locked in at the origination of the contract. That ideally will keep this process as simple as possible and allow users of financial statements to clearly understand the difference between profit and loss and OCI.
You mentioned there, Daryl, that we were talking about requiring the use of OCI rather than permitting it, and I think that's quite an important thing. I think that decision really stemmed from the board thinking that the objectives of highlighting the underwriting results and separating the reversing changes from the non-reversing changes really were more important in their minds compared to the one of eliminating accounting mismatch in this case. I think the boards have accepted that there will be some accounting mismatch, but they're comfortable with that, I think, because of the balance sheet will be overall on a current value. One important area where I think we're going to need to come back to do some work is in the area around participating contracts, and particularly unit-linked ones. We had, of course, previously a decision about the mirroring approach, which means that the measurement and presentation of a liability is consistent with any underlying assets and liabilities or any other sorts of underlying items. And I think that point was noted at the board table with a request that we would come back and consider that in future. Good, so that was the use of other comprehensive income, and after so many education sessions over the last 6 months, I think it was quite useful to finally get some decisions on that, and it will be a topic we'll discuss with the Insurance Working Group at the end of the month. Another topic the board discussed, another long-standing contentious topic really, was that on acquisition costs. And the boards were asked to think about how they would account for acquisition costs. This really fed from some of the disagreements that the boards had leading up to the publication of the exposure draft. But of course, in the exposure draft, we didn't have premium claims and expenses in the statement comprehensive income. We only had a summarised margin approach. So the question of when you recognise revenue and expense wasn't quite so important. The boards have since, of course, decided that we should have premiums, claims and expenses in the statement of comprehensive income. So the need to think of this is really a consequence of that decision. It was a difficult discussion, I think.
I think that's right, Andrea. I think probably the biggest complication we have with this is, as you mentioned, it's something that we hadn't previously thought about when we issued the ED. The idea of bringing premiums onto the income statement is one that we've had to spend a fair amount of time thinking about, and in particular the way that that is allocated over the periods of time, of the period of an insurance contract. In the discussion, the boards recognised that there were some interlocking things that meant that it would be very difficult to make some decisions without having made other decisions first. We were able to make a few decisions. I think it was important that we agreed that the cash flows related to the acquisition costs form part of the contractual cash flows and insurance contract and aren't a separate or don't comprise a separate balance sheet item, in this case an asset of their own right. But what we did agree is that we need to spend a little bit of time thinking about this further, think about it in the context of premium, and look at a way that we can then take it from there. The biggest disagreement, I think, between the two boards on this one at the outset was whether or not we spread acquisition costs over the life of the contract, or whether we can take them immediately in the period that they happen. And that's something that the FASB were able to give us at least a fairly firm steer from their perspective on what they felt, and they feel that it should be spread. The ISB still feels it would like to wait for further information on premium income before it makes a decision. I think it's important to say that having made the decision that we want to record premium income gross, we're becoming aware of the complexity of actually doing that and what that entails. We always mention the fact that our decisions are tentative, and I guess moving away from the summarized margin is something that we could only do, we'll only be able to finally do once we understand what the full implications are.
Okay, and you mentioned that we got fairly strong steers from the boards in two different areas. Really, the FESB gave a strong steer that it wanted to see the acquisition cost expense and the income associated with that spread over the contract term one way or the other. And the ISB gave a fairly strong steer that it wanted to see the acquisition costs and the cash flows one way or the other. And I guess the staff's task is to work out whether there's something in between that we can manage to satisfy the needs of both boards or not. Okay, so the last topic we discussed was a review of unbundling, and I think there were three different parts of this discussion. There was a discussion about following up from last month or the month before's discussion about whether or not some investment components are so distinct that they should be unbundled because there are no interrelated cash flows between the investment component and the insurance component. We did a review of all the decisions, and I'm pleased to see the board seemed pretty happy with where they've landed up and all the various different things that can be unbundled, the embedded derivatives, the goods and services, and also on the disaggregation decisions. And finally, we discussed whether unbundling should be permitted or required. We decided whether unbundling should be permitted if the boards hadn't already required unbundling. So let's start with the first one on distinct investment components. I think the start of the discussion, we had a little bit of debate about the extent to which cash flows were interrelated and whether or not they should be more extensive or less extensive unbundling.
I think the general feeling of the boards, although as you mentioned we did discuss this at length, is that there should be less unbundling. So we would see the unbundling criteria as we've thought them through at this stage, applying to relatively few contracts where the investment component is completely unrelated to the insurance component. And we spent some time in the discussion trying to get the wording right and get the approach correct so that it would result in relatively little unbundling. Primarily what we've ended up deciding is that we believe that insurance contracts or an investment component should only be unbundled if it is distinct. And in defining distinct, we've defined it as the situation where the two components, the insurance component and the investment component, are not highly interrelated. In defining highly interrelated, we haven't really tried to give a specific definition per se, but what we're looking to do is perhaps give a couple of indicators. I think the first indicator is that the two would be considered potentially interrelated if they matured or expired at the same time, or if one could lapse only if they had to be or they could lapse at different times, would indicate that in fact they were not interrelated. A second indicator for us was that similar products are not sold separately in the same market or jurisdiction, and that's quite important. If they're not sold in a separate jurisdiction, if they're not sold separately in the same jurisdiction, that would be an indicator that they're in fact are interrelated, that they can only be sold together. And I think the third indicator, and to me maybe the most important one, and here I'm giving a personal view, is the fact that they should be measured separately. So if one component can only be measured by reference to the other component, that's an indicator that they're highly interrelated. The idea behind giving these sorts of indicators is obviously to allow a little bit of discretion and judgment in the process of determining the test of highly interrelated, but we believe these three tests are actually really important in getting to that answer.
Yeah, just to expand on that a little bit, I think the focus was on whether the insurance component and investment component can live separate lives and can always live separate lives. And on the one about being sold in the same market or jurisdiction, the board, or some board members in particular, were very keen to emphasise that just because it wasn't sold doesn't mean that automatically you get to the conclusion that it was interrelated. It might just be that they haven't sold it yet. And so that needed to be considered as well. I think there were two examples which were raised at the board table which kind of highlight the sort of way the board was thinking. One was the deposit account, which has a free gift of insurance. But when the deposit is withdrawn, then the insurance lapses. And although you could have separate lives for part of that contract, there are situations where there isn't a separate life. And so for that reason, the board's concluded that that should not be in bundle. It should all be accounted for as an insurance contract. The other example, which was the one that you mentioned at the end, which is very important, is the value of the insurance component depends very much on the value of the investment component, because it makes up an investment to a predetermined amount, and how much you have in the investment, the pot count, will affect the value of the insurance. So again, that one would not be unbundled. It would all be treated as insurance. And I think that, you know, it's consistent with the way we've developed the insurance contract standard, as seeing the contract as a bundle of interrelated rights and obligations. So that was the final piece, really, in the unbundling and disaggregation decisions. And we also had a review paper which set out all the various decisions so far, because we've taken them in dribs and drabs over a number of times. And, you know, I think they sort of hang together reasonably well. And again, we'll be testing that with the insurance working group and putting out all the decisions in one place so that we can see how they work together.
I think it was important there for the board to actually get a view of how the whole package worked and to get an understanding of how it came together. And I think the board actually expressed comfort with it. So I think we got a unanimous view from both boards that this was in fact the right answer, and that it felt like it all worked together.
Thank you. As part of that review, we also talked about whether unbundling should be permitted, because I think there's some jurisdictions where there's been unbundling in the past and they're concerned that they will now be prohibited from unbundling. Your own one in particular, I think, Daniel.
And I think, Andrea, this was one of the more difficult decisions, because I guess what we needed to think through in our own minds was whether or not we were proposing unbundling because we saw it as we were limiting unbundling because we saw it as a practical expedient. In other words, we were concerned primarily about operational issues, mm-hmm. and therefore limiting unbundling. Or, in fact, we were limiting unbundling because we saw it as the right answer. And I think the board felt very strongly that we see it as the right answer. We believe that unbundling is the appropriate way to treat certain instruments, but that is not the appropriate way to treat other instruments. And we believe the test that we've proposed with the indicators that we put in place actually draws that line correctly. Once you get to that space, and once you've made that decision that the line is drawn correctly, you need to require it.
Yes.
Because that says that it's the correct way of
it. It becomes a scope question, really. It becomes a question of which is the appropriate standard to apply to this sort of thing. And it's something that, you know, questions of scope is something that the board normally decides. It doesn't give an option, and this thinking is entirely consistent with that. Good, so a busy meeting, lots of hours of insurance contracts, and some significant progress forward, I think, in terms of the project. We have, of course, the insurance working group at the end of the month, and we'll be planning to review a lot of these decisions, report back on where the board has landed in many of these places, and also seek input on some of the remaining topics left in the project. Beyond that, I think we're heading fast towards the summer, which was when we thought we would wrap up deliberations. We're on course to get all the substantial deliberations done by then, and we hope to be issuing a due process document by the end of the year. Thank you for listening, everyone.